You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan Grayson calling out the Tea Party. He started out making a comment that the Tea Party had a popularity level that was similar to that of the KKK. Tea Party got pretty upset about that, pushed back on it. And so Grayson just issued a fairly lengthy statement. I'll just share a piece of it with you very briefly. And then Jennifer Burke of the Tea Party would like to rebut it. He said, "The president visited my home of Orlando, and Tea Party protesters shouted, 'Kenyon, go home.' They chanted, 'Bye-bye, Blackbird,' and carried posters saying, 'Obama's plan, white slavery. Imam Obama wants to ban pork, and the zoo has an African lion, and the White House has a lion African.' They held a picture of the president of the United States as an African witch doctor with bananas in his hair. Tea Party members have also persisted in falsely characterizing the president as Kenyan and Muslim, despite all evidence, in order to disparage him. Members of the Tea Party have circulated countless altered pictures depicting President Obama and the First Lady as monkeys. Tea Party members have also called my fellow member of Congress, civil rights hero John Lewis, an N-word, and Barney Frank a F-word. More generally, the leader of the Texas Tea Party displayed a poster saying, 'Congress equals slave owner, taxpayer equals N-word.' Tea Party members," he actually spelled the word out, of course, "Tea Party members of Congress have referred to Hispanics as wetbacks and having cantaloupe-sized calves from picking fruit. Tea Party candidates, including my opponent in the last election, endorsed forcing Hispanics to speak English." He said one could go on because there's overwhelming evidence that the Tea Party is the home of bigotry and discrimination in America today, just as the KKK was from an earlier generation. Therefore, I say, if the hood fits, wear it. Jennifer Burke, the National Outreach Director of TeaParty.net, the largest Tea Party group in America. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on your show.
Sure. So do you take issue with any of the facts, or do you assert that any of these things that Alan Grayson says are not facts?
I most of the things you read, I've never heard of. I have no idea what he's talking about.
I've seen all of
attended
these.
Tea Party rallies in Florida and Arizona and Washington State, on the liberal side of Washington State, the Seattle area. Never witnessed any signs like that. I don't know whether he saw signs like that in Florida. I have absolutely no idea. But there have been disparaging things done on both sides of the aisle. Did Alan Grayson say something when Alan West was depicted as a gold-toothed boxer knocking out white women? I don't recall hearing him defend them.
Well, there was no organization that was doing
MSNBC
was
just the other day, and they depicted Ted Cruz. They had Cruz's wife with the gang type writing on your fingers with fists being shown. So
I don't understand. There's not a parallel organization to the Tea Party on the left, is there?
Well, Occupy Wall Street is the one that tried to rise up to counter, which Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama blessed them and the work that they were doing.
So was Occupy Wall Street using racist imagery?
I wasn't really following Occupy Wall Street.
Just as a serious question,
I've never attended an Occupy Wall Street event. So
sure.
I can't speak to that, but do you deny that depicting Alan West as a gold-toothed boxer is a racist imagery?
I think it's deplorable.
Depicting Condoleezza Rice as an Aunt Jemima racist imagery, the things that happened to.
Yeah, but I don't think Alan Grayson did that.
No, he didn't, but did he condone it? Because the thing is, depicting the Tea Party. And
so if Alan Grayson doesn't come out and condemn every stupid racist remark by somebody on the left, he is therefore a racist?
He's condoning it. That's what most of the things you've just mentioned. In fact, that you just mentioned, Tom, I've never heard of. I have black Tea Party friends in Florida, in the South, in all parts of these United States that have spoken, that have sung, that have attended, And I have not heard of any of these things. I've never seen.
Here in D.C. just last week, we had a Tea Party rally where, you know, a guy walked to the White House with a Confederate flag.
One person out of thousands.
Yeah.
It amazes
okay. Well, then Jennifer.
It amazes me that the left tries to take their racist history and equate that what Alan Grayson did was equate people who, in the KKK, was formed by the Democrats.
Oh, the Democratic Party was absolutely the party of racism. I mean,
by the tree
in the early 20th century, absolutely. And they changed in the 1960s. And as you, I'm sure, know, in the 1970s, Richard Nixon's Southern strategy was to reach out to Southern racists, and that's why when Ronald Reagan was nominated to be president, the first speech that he gave as a presidential candidate, his first official speech, was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where those three civil rights workers were murdered. And he gave a speech about states' rights, wink, wink.
States' rights now equals racism, so Ronald Reagan was...
It certainly did in 1980. In 1980, there was still an ongoing effort to roll back the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Yes.
You mean the Civil Rights Act of the Democrats?
Of the 60s.
Tried to stop from happening?
No, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act that the Democrats passed overwhelmingly, Lyndon Johnson signed, that's how the Democrats lost the South. He told Bill Moyers at the time he signed it, if I sign this thing, the Democratic Party's going to lose the South for a generation. Turns out it's been two generations. But Jennifer, right. Without playing gotcha, I really don't want to play gotcha here. What I want to do is ask you just this really simple question. There is, and you know this, there is a huge well or pool of white racists in the South, and there's a fair number of them in the North. I grew up in Michigan, and I've been to Michigan militia events back when I was a teenager, and they were white racists. They would use racist language easily. That group, that slice of people, has been used for political purposes by both parties over the years. The Democrats used to be, the Democratic Party used to pander them until the 60s. The Republican Party has been pandering to them since then. What do you think that, and it seems like a lot of them have gravitated to the Tea Party. Not to say that the Tea Party is full of racists, but a lot of the racists seem to be gravitating to the Tea Party. What do you think the Tea Party should do about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about, that all the racists have gravitated towards the Tea Party.
Not all of them.
Or that even a large part. I've been a member of the Tea Party movement since its inception, and I've not seen it. Now, what I have seen is a history in the Democrat Party of having a control factor under the guise of compassion for black people. It was Lyndon Johnson that said, and this holds true to this day, and these are his words, I'll have, during his Great Society push, I'll have those niggers voting Democrat for the next 200 years. And that's the stronghold that they have had, that guise of compassion, let us take care of you, and then
I have
anybody
a no knowledge of Lyndon Johnson ever saying that.
Anybody that tries to get them to see beyond skin color and to see beyond a certain circumstance, the government does not have to be the answer. And if you ask me, Democrats constantly pushing big government as the answer to everybody's problem. I was a teacher for 12 years. I witnessed generational welfare and that desire and that belief that they can accomplish more from a young black child being stripped away from them because of what they are being fed by the left.
Right.
That is bigotry and racism in this country.
Well, it's not always productive. I'll grant you that. Lyndon Johnson did cut poverty in half in the United States, both in the poor black and the poor white communities, and set the stage for an emerging black middle class in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Black bearing under Obama right now. Black unemployment is higher.
Oh, it's a disaster. 32 years of Reaganomics has ripped the guts out of our economy. Jennifer Burke, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Jennifer Burke, you can read your website over at teaparty.net. Jennifer, thank you for being with us. Oh, she did? And welcome back. Andrew Campbell is on the line with us, senior producer of The Big Picture. And hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good. You're welcome. So we're going to start out with Daryl Issa.
Yeah, we're going to start off with a little intro rant on Issa. As we all know, he's the witch hunter extraordinaire in Washington and on Capitol Hill. He went after the IRS scandal. When he couldn't get results there, he started up Benghazi, and now he's turning his eyes towards Obamacare.
Yeah, and by calling the, I'd say the IRS so-called scandal. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. And Chris Allman and Andrew Kloster are going to be with us. Has Andrew been with us before?
Actually, Andrew's going to be replaced tonight by Neil McCabe.
Oh, okay.
Who's been on plenty of times. And
sure.
He's always a good get, and he always has some interesting takes, so it should be a great rumble.
Okay.
And we're going to be talking about a new study that says that poverty and really growing up in poverty can affect neurologically the development of children's brains. It can really lead to mental health issues, and it can also contribute to higher rates of mortality. Mm-hmm. If that's not proof that we need to have a new war on poverty, I don't know what is.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I just spoke with a Tea Party person who was telling me that the government is not the solution. I'm not sure what she thinks is the solution. Maybe perhaps one of our viewers or listeners knows. I don't know. Anyhow. So Larry Flynt, he says, don't execute the man who paralyzed me.
Yeah, Larry Flynt, people probably know him as the founder and publisher of Hustler magazine. He's a very strong defender of the First Amendment as well. But now he's coming out to talk about he was shot by an individual who was punished by being given the death penalty. And now Larry is saying, don't execute this guy. He doesn't believe in the death penalty. He doesn't think that his assailant should be killed.
Yeah. Very interesting. And John, how do you pronounce this guy's last name, the software
McAfee,
guy?
John McAfee.
McAfee. Okay. John McAfee, he's kind of eccentric. I mean,
yeah, he's people probably know his name from his software, McAfee computer software.
Yeah.
He also was caught up in the news, I believe it was last year or 2 years ago,
he was accused of murder.
Yeah, he was accused of
murdering his next-door neighbor in some weird island someplace.
Yeah, down in
Central America.
Latin America, Central America, yeah. So he was in the news then. And now he's in the news because the House GOP has asked him to come inform them about the Obamacare website debacle.
Right.
And they want some advice from him on how he probably would have done things better.
That should be entertaining.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it should be entertaining. And our daily take?
The daily take, basically, you're going to be talking about why we should stop treating capitalists like they're gods, because they're really not.
Yeah, and giving them a special tax rate. You know, that Romney and Paris Hilton, they pay a maximum 20% tax rate. Isn't that sweet?
Yep.
And so, anyhow, yeah. So... Oops. Hang on just a second. There we go. So that's the whole show, right?
Yeah, it should be a great show.
Covered all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well done there.
Great. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Andrew Campbell, and we will be right back here. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Stick around. Welcome back, John Hartman here with you. Marion Gurman is with us, a citizen activist in the Pacific Northwest with No Nukes Northwest. The website is nonukesnw.wordpress.com. Marion, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
I was doing a fundraiser for KABU in Portland, and I heard this radiation report as part of their newscast. And I thought, this is so amazing. They're reporting, you know, the radiation in Portland, in different parts of Portland. Tell us about this.
Well, it came about a while ago. There's been a lot of people who are interested in finding out about radiation due to Fukushima primarily. And the interest here should actually be more than that. It should be about Hanford, which is just about 177 miles up the Columbia from us. And we also have our own nuclear plant with its own set of problems. But, of course, you know, Fukushima takes precedence right now, and it should. And we weren't getting information from our government or from the EPA regarding what radiation is falling on us, how much, where, in the water, in our food, or anything. And we knew that somehow there's got to be radiation falling. So we decided a long time ago, about 2 years ago, that we would get Geiger counters and start to learn how to do this. And one thing led to another. We met incredible people along the way who have become our teachers, people from a group called RadWatch, which was founded by someone in Seattle, Deb in Seattle, and Ray in Ontario, and as many people internationally on board who all contribute radiation readings to one site. And then what we do is we take those sites, we take the averages in the Northwest, which is RadCast, we take all the averages, and we take all of those reads, and we put them out on the radio and say, this is what's going on. And if we happen to have rainfall that was hot rain, meaning had some radiation fallout in it, we would also put a note on that to the people saying, if you're in Portland, you really need to stay inside today. It would be wise, or bring an umbrella. If your dog is going out, please clean your dog when you get back home. Things like that.
Have you found that to be the case?
Sorry?
Have you found that to be the case? Or have there been days where you actually have hot rain? You have rain that that is more radioactive than the background rain or the background air?
We have hot rain. We had hot rain about 2 months ago, and it was particularly hot, and it scared me.
How hot?
So I called. It was at the time. It was a 198 counts per minute.
And what is normal
here?
for our viewers and listeners who don't know what normal?
Normal is such a good question. What is normal? This is something that is not debated among those of us who watch radiation, because we know that normal would be zero. But we have background radiation, for instance, out in Portland, where I am, in radon, in the ground.
Sure.
You know, we're at a high area for that. In eastern
wherever there's
Washington.
Granite.
Yeah. Exactly. But so we don't have details on what normal was before Fukushima. We can only speculate because the EPA and the government won't tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to have it somewhere, but we don't know what that is. So we figured, just from looking back at different graphs over time, that normal for us before Fukushima was probably, in this area, was probably 17 or 18 counts per minute.
Right.
And at this point, it is now an average here where I am in North Portland. It is 35 to 37.
And you had a rainfall that was over 100 and...
It was close to 200 counts per minute.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, now that only happened, as far as I know, since I've been doing rain swipes. It's only been like that once here. And it's really important to understand that alarming people isn't what we're about.
Right.
We're about teaching people that
right.
this exists.
Yeah, today's just a bad day to go out.
Exactly.
It's funny. It's not funny actually, but in 1986, I flew. It was in early May, because I remember it was my birthday. I flew over to Germany and landed in Frankfurt, and I had not known, or I knew, but I didn't realize the significance of the meltdown at Chernobyl, which had happened just a few days earlier. And I got off the plane and took the train into downtown Frankfurt, and it was raining. And I walked out of the train station, and the city was empty. There was nobody anywhere. I walked two blocks in the rain wearing a raincoat to my hotel, and the guy at the hotel immediately freaked out and took my raincoat off me and said he had a fellow who was going to take it downstairs and wash it, and then explained to me that rain was filled with radiation from Fukushima or from Chernobyl, and that the government had been on television warning everybody to stay inside. Now, apparently our government here is doing nothing like that. Have you talked with Senator Wyden, for example, the senior senator from Oregon?
Yeah, I've talked with Wyden's office numerous times. And there's a lot of interest from people on Wyden's staff, and I have to commend them for that, because when we call them to tell them what's going on, they really listen to us. The question becomes, what happens once it reaches the senator? And all I can tell you is that we still don't have an international group of scientists put together that can go over to Japan and deal with what's going on
right.
in Fukushima. So we call, we worked out an agreement with the office that if we get counts here in Portland, which we had recently, about 3 weeks ago, that were over 60, and these are just spikes, this wasn't an average here,
right.
That I would call Senator Wyden's office, they would answer my call, and I would tell them, hey, we just got a count of 60 here. We've never had that. And please tell the senator.
Right. But so far you've got no response. Have you guys been checking the seafood?
We are working right now, yes, but we are working right now at buying a spectrometer so that we can actually find out what's in the seafood. We do have a member from No Nukes Northwest who went out with our Geiger counter, and I actually have a Geiger counter here to show people what they look like.
Sure.
But he went out and he was testing seaweed and fish areas where, you know, the fish were coming in from the boats.
Right.
And there was one sample that was very high.
Huh.
And, you know, alarming. But we knew, and it was tuna. And we've known now for over a year from California that the tuna has been completely affected.
Yeah.
By,
so the tuna are carrying the radiation from the Pacific into the West
yeah.
Coast. Miriam, we have to run, but people, what's the best website?
You can get in touch with us at No Nukes Northwest on Facebook, and we can just steer you from there.
Okay, so go to Facebook.
No Nukes Northwest on Facebook.
Go to No Nukes Northwest.
Right.
On Facebook. Great. Miriam Gurman, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And keep up the great work. Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
See, that is the face of citizen activism. That is what we all need to be doing. Getting out there and doing something. Informing the public. Who will tell the people, right? Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. You know, yesterday I started going off on libertarianism, and this idea that has so seduced so many young people in the United States. It's really quite remarkable. You know, the people who follow Ron Paul and now Rand Paul and others, that somehow if you just get government out of the way, that everything is going to be wonderful. Our first guest, Jennifer Burke, the National Outreach Director of TeaParty.net, herself an African-American woman, which is why when she dropped the N-word on the air, I didn't, you know, bleep it or anything or stop her. I'm baffled is not the right word. We just this extraordinary study just recently came out that found that children of poverty have about a third fewer vocabulary words when they're 2 or 3 years old. They have a less well-regulated reaction to emotional images throughout their lives. So they're basically less in control of themselves. What we refer to as prefrontal executive function, right? The forward brain. That this is one of the primary mechanisms by which poverty echoes itself down to future generations. Right? A child growing up in poverty is exposed to constant stress, is exposed to, and as you know, are their parents. And in fact, they're, you know, I've talked before, I wrote a book about this called The Edison Gene. There's a whole chapter on this in there about how when mom is pregnant, when a woman is pregnant, the baby, the fetus, is essentially constantly throughout the 9 months of pregnancy inquiring of mom, is this a safe world or an unsafe world into which I'm going to be born? And mom is constantly feeding that information back. And the mechanism that is used for that communication is a hormone called cortisol, which the body produces, mom's body produces, when it's under stress at high levels and produces at very low levels when she's not under stress. And the science is absolutely in on this, that when the developing fetus is exposed to high levels of cholesterol, it actually alters the way the brain develops during the 9 months of pregnancy, particularly the last 6 months of gestation. With high levels of cholesterol, in other words, mom is experiencing stress, high levels of cortisol, What you have is an exaggerated development of what's called the hindbrain, the lower brain functions, fight or flight, physical response, instant emotional reaction. You have a greater development of that and a lesser development of what would be called forebrain functions or frontal brain functions, which are things like intellectual development, self-control, self-regulation, emotional regulation. Those things get sacrificed in exchange for fight or flight. Because, hey, it's a dangerous world. You're going to need a lot of fight or flight. So the stresses associated with poverty, and they are there and they are real, actually produce children who find it harder to make it through school and thus find harder to find a decent job and thus harder to have a decent income. And they don't live as long and they don't live as well and they don't live as mentally and physically healthy and emotionally healthy, all because they were literally born into poverty. So Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s, and I wish Jennifer had stayed on the line. I would have loved to have had a conversation with her about this. As a young African-American woman, who I'm guessing does not, if she's with the Tea Party, and I don't want to personalize this too much, but, well, actually, I'm not going to personalize it at all. I'm not going to speak about Jennifer. She's not here to defend herself or to speak for herself, and I have no right to speak for her or about her. Let me speak more generically. Johnson was presented with this information that poverty is multigenerational and that there are a variety of reasons, but some of them are actually physiological. And that if we can break that cycle of poverty for just one generation, so the next pregnant mom who has a baby doesn't raise that child in poverty, then you'll have a group of children who can grow up to have nice, decent, middle-class lives and produce children who were not, you know, gestated in a soup of cortisol, and thus can function in society in ways that can get them into the middle class and even above that if they choose. And so he declared war on poverty with the Great Society, with things like food stamps and housing vouchers and, just welfare programs, basically, saying we're not going to let people fall below a point where they have to worry about food and housing. And over the next 6 years, following Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, poverty in the United States, and this is, I know the Republican Party would like people to think that most poor people in the United States are black, and whenever they hear poor or poverty, they associate it with African Americans. The reality is most poor people in the United States are white, simply because most people in the United States are white. Proportionally, there's greater poverty in the African American community, which you would expect after a genocide and hundreds of years of slavery and then, you know, a century of institutionalized segregation. But it, you know, the Great Society affected both white people and people of color. And what Johnson did is he cut the poverty level in half in those 6 years. And it really needed to be added on to. And had Richard Nixon not committed treason by contacting the South Vietnamese in 1968 and telling them not to go to France and negotiate with LBJ to end the war in Vietnam, because he had the war in Vietnam, he had that thing wrapped up in August and September of 68. And then Nixon blew it up. And I have played for you many times the audio tape of Nixon, of LBJ. This was just released a couple of years ago by the LBJ Library, the tape of LBJ and Everett Dirksen talking about this. In fact, here it is. This should have been a New York Times headline, though. Like I said, it was just released 3 years ago. Here it is.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know,
says Everett Dirksen. So Nixon became president by treason, by blowing up the peace negotiations with South Vietnam and North Vietnam. And he didn't undo the Great Society, but he stopped it in its tracks. He didn't expand it. And then, of course, Nixon was followed by Ford, who was followed by Reagan. Well, actually, no, who was followed by Carter. And Carter was not able to expand that. And then we got Reagan and Bush, and Clinton actually, you know, kind of ripped it apart, ended welfare as we know it. But had that program been expanded, we would see what you see in many northern European countries, where you don't have this serious multi-generational poverty like we have here in the United States. In fact, it's interesting. There's a new book out. What if Kennedy hadn't been killed? The title is Words to That Effect. What if Kennedy had lived? And you have to wonder, how different would America be if Hubert Humphrey had won that 68 election and continued expanding the Great Society? And we had actually stamped out poverty in the United States, because Humphrey was an old-style FDR Democrat instead of Nixon. And what if Jimmy Carter had beat Ronald Reagan? What if Reagan hadn't cut a deal with the Ayatollahs to hold the hostages in exchange for spare parts for their military? How would history be different? How do you think history would be different if we hadn't had three illegitimate Republican presidents since Eisenhower? Nixon, who committed treason by blowing up the Vietnam peace talks. Reagan, who committed treason by cutting a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages when they didn't want to. And George W. Bush, who only won because his brother illegally knocked 60,000 African Americans off the voting rolls in Florida just weeks before the election, making it close enough that he could take it to the Supreme Court and have the Supreme Court declare him the winner, even when the later count by the New York Times showed that Al Gore won the 2000 election. How would history be different?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There has not been a legitimate Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower. How would America be different if the Democrats had held the White House for each one of those three administrations? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norman. Norma, what's on? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
I wanted to know if you're aware of today in the House, they're working on this, what they call the water bill, the waterways resource, and can't remember the whole thing. It's H.R. 3080. It's going to move the Army Corps of Engineers supposedly from executive control into Congress control, and they're going to streamline the way they handle the waterways. Supposedly it's going to help improve our ports for the larger ships that will be coming through the larger Panama Canal to help improve trade. Mm-hmm. But it also streamlines the environmental issues so that the studies will not be so long, and help rearrange the money that's used from the trust funds, the waterway trust funds, to help build new locks and dams on the waterway systems, which seems to make West Virginia and Ohio happy, so they'll be able to ship more coal to China.
Hmm.
Are you aware of this bill?
No, I'm not. You just made me aware of it, though. Thank you for that.
Oh, sorry. But when they start talking about moving it into Congress's control and being able to increase public and private input into this, I get very suspicious about what they're doing.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. The House is supposed to be closest to the people because they're elected every 2 years. But they've gerrymandered this thing, and the Supreme Court has changed the rules of the game of elections so that the House now is arguably the most closely owned subsidiary of the billionaires in corporate America. So I share your concern and...
Well, if you put this with the clause in the new farm bill that limits Environmental Protection Agency supervision and inspections, I'm wondering if this also is going to cut the legs out of the Environmental Protection Agency in the way that they dredge rivers and the way they expand the banks and cut down trees to increase the size of locks and dams.
Yeah, I think you could count on it. I think you could count on it. That's pretty amazing. Norma, what were you watching this on C-SPAN? Is that how you learned this?
Yes, I've been watching that. And I had not known that this bill was coming up. I've been watching for that farm bill because if you can't let the Environmental Protection Agency inspect the runoff from farms, including in pesticides, you know about this.
Right.
And the way that the insecticides are affecting the environment and the way the...
Yep.
If you remember the flood back in, I think it was in Montana, where the woman drowned, they couldn't find her because of the foam from the runoff. And if you keep cutting the legs out from under Environmental Protection Agency, and you're going to keep moving this coal down the Ohio to the Tennessee, to the Mississippi, and through the ports, you're dragging coal all across the country just to sell to China.
Right.
This doesn't help our environment at all.
No. No. It makes the fossil fuel industry rich, though, and they're the ones who are buying Congress. Were Democrats speaking up against this?
No, it looks like both sides are thinking about how wonderful this is to improve all of our ports. Well, improving the ports, dredging the ports may be a great thing for commerce.
Right.
But if you start...
But is it the best thing for us or for the planet? Yeah.
Start rearranging...
No, I got it. Norma, we're out of time, but thank you for sharing that. I'm going to have to do a little homework. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And very interesting. Doug in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Doug, thanks for listening to 760 AM. What's up?
Hi, it's an honor to talk to you. I've got a lot of stuff to say, but this time only one, and that is that the woman who gave a quote about LBJ saying that that the Democratic Party was going to have the vote niggers vote for the next 200 years.
Yeah, let's not use that word, Doug, on the air, please.
Okay. That's the first time I've used it. Yeah,
let's just not do it. I let her use that word because she herself was African American. It's like I'm very uncomfortable with that. Let's not.
I am too, and I appreciate you reminding me of that fact.
Thank you.
But that exact quote you can find all over the internet on right wing blogs and quotes, and it can be traced back to one book by a very right-wing author by the name of Ronald Kessler, and it's in a book called Inside the White House, and it's never been corroborated by anybody else, and he is the guy who, this Kessler is the guy who falsely reported that Obama had been attending those sermons in that church, which were so anti-American, when actually Obama wasn't even in the church at the time.
Uh-huh.
And he's done a lot of other right-wing stuff. And that's the only person who ever alleged that LBJ said that that I can find.
To say that trying to eliminate poverty in the United States, when the vast majority of people in poverty in the United States were white, was going to somehow win the Democratic Party, the black vote for 200 years. It doesn't make any sense that LBJ would say such a thing. It's not how he spoke. It's not how he thought. And it certainly wasn't his motivation. But it has clearly brainwashed some young conservatives. You know, it's just astounding. Doug, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Vince in Riverside, California. Hey, Vince.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I watch your show, and it seems to me like you try to do the right thing. And, you know, you really care about these issues and that. But I'm going to have to tell you, I remember when both Jimmy Carter were president and when Bill Clinton was president. Bill Clinton, you said that he basically destroyed the welfare system. He was very much for the working people. So I find that hard to believe.
Bill Clinton bragged that he had ended welfare as we know it. Welfare, he changed it. It's now called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF. He right. time limited it to either 4 or 5 years. That was now this wasn't just Bill Clinton. It was Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. And the idea was nobody should be on welfare. We don't want to have multi-generational welfare. So we're just going to cut people off at an arbitrary time limit, 4 or 5 years. It wasn't.
Well, you tell me then, why was the unemployment so low during his?
Because we were living in a bubble. It didn't hurt people during that time because the economy was being turbocharged by Greenspan's crazy Fed policies. And then on top of that, you had the dot-com bubble going on during the Clinton presidency. So, you know, there wasn't as much poverty in the United States, and the poverty we had wasn't as severe, and there wasn't as, you know, and the radical wealth was just starting to accumulate during that time because that was right after the Reagan tax cuts. And so, you know, Clinton didn't see the damage that his policies did. They're obvious now, but he didn't see them at that time. Now that we've had a recession that has lasted more than 4 years and people are timing out of welfare and there's no way that they can find a job because they're living in places where 50 people show up for every one job application, we've got a problem and we're back to this grinding, you know, really literally hunger-inducing poverty.
Well, you know, you're over looking one fact.
Which is?
The fact is that most people today are falling for this nonsense that the corporations are doing where oil companies are getting subsidies from the government. They're not paying a tax rate that's anywhere near what it was in the 60s or 70s or 80s. And when you talk about Jimmy Carter, the reason he was out of office is because he became so left-wing that even Democrats couldn't support him anymore. He is the only Democrat
Vince,
I've ever not voted for.
Vince, I was, you know, I voted for Jimmy Carter. I voted for him twice. Jimmy Carter became left-wing? What are you talking about? Jimmy Carter was, you know, up until about 2 months before the election, the conventional wisdom was that Jimmy Carter was going to easily win that election. The reason he lost is because the hostages were held. And if you look at, just go to the Christian Science Monitor, Google Christian Science Monitor and President Bonnie Sauter of Iran. He wrote an op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor, just like in March of this year. And it was, put the word Argo in too when you do it, because he was talking back to Argo and, you know, to kind of rebutting the movie Argo. And what he was saying was that he ran his campaign, he ran for president. Bonnie Sauter ran for president and said, in fact, here, let me quote to you from it. Indeed, in the early days, there was no talk of hostage taking. The occupation was initially regarded as a short-term protest against the United States, against the Shah's admittance to the United States, as the memory of the 53 coup of Mossadegh was in fresh memory. Soon after the occupation, Barghazan resigned. I became responsible for the foreign ministry. During this time, I called all the ambassadors and told them that this occupation was a strike against the government. It was we who were held hostage. I asked them to help. Soon after Iran had a presidential election, I openly opposed the hostage taking throughout the election campaign, telling students that occupying an embassy in the heart of Tehran was a sign of cowardice. And then he goes on. He says, I won the election with over 76% of the vote. Other candidates were also openly against hostage taking, and overall 96% of votes in that election were given to candidates who were against it. And so he's going on and on about how Iran didn't actually want to have these hostages. So he wins the presidential position in Iran. It's 1980. The election's going on in the United States. And then he says, Ayatollah Khomeini and Ronald Reagan had organized a clandestine negotiation which prevented the attempts by myself and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter to free the hostages before the 1980 U.S. presidential election took place. The fact that they were never released tipped the results of the election in favor of Reagan. Right there in the Christian Science Monitor. You can read it from the president of Iran himself. Vince, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com, carbonite.com, automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com, angieslist.com, detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at angieslist.com, stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com, and our website, tomhartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide via the Free Speech TV Network. Very pleased to have you back with us, and also very pleased to have back with us the former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, the Republican from Georgia. He was my congressman for a number of years, candidate for the 2012 Republican Party presidential nomination, Newt Gingrich. GingrichProductions.com is his website. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, Congressman, whatever, welcome back.
Just go for Newt. It's much easier.
Yeah, I suppose it is. And I should mention, when you and I are done talking, we're gonna have a quick break, and then your wife, Callista, has a new book out, and we're going to speak with her about Ellis the Elephant and the founding of America and the American Revolution. I'm curious your thoughts on the idea that this fight within the Republican Party. I've heard it characterized as almost like the Whigs emerging out of the old Democratic Republic, or out of the old Federalists. Do you see any parallels to that time?
No, not that particular analogy. I think there are other periods you can look at, like the rise of the populist and the progressives in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century.
The split between perhaps the radical Republicans and the Republicans during Reconstruction?
To some extent, you might pick that example. I mean, what you have are a group of people who believe that they were elected by constituents who would rather have them fight than compromise, and a group of people who believe they were elected by constituents who would rather have them compromise than fight. And those are two pretty big differences in style and approach and how they try to get things done.
Well, and wouldn't it be reasonable to suggest that, I mean, I'd rather, frankly, have my progressive Democratic members fight than compromise. I think, you know, when you guys said, or when the Republicans said, you know, we want to cut Social Security, for example, they should have said, well, you know, we want to lower the eligibility age to 55, you know, which would tighten up the labor market and would actually produce a lot more revenue for Social Security. Or, you know, when people started complaining about Obamacare, they should have said, well, you know, we want to lower the eligibility age for Medicare to zero and just have a national single-payer health care system. It already exists. But, you know, why is it that the Democrats, you know, Republicans come out with these, you know, strong and sometimes outrageous positions, and the only Democrat I know who's doing that is Alan Grayson. I mean, taking on the Tea Party and comparing them to the Klan, which is hyperbolic, but it got the point. You know, it got the message out, and you know, things that Republicans have done in many cases have been hyperbolic, but they get their message out.
But you have a number of Democrats who, for example, who strongly favor a single-payer system.
Yes.
And would replace Obamacare by moving to the left.
But nobody's paying attention to them.
Well, I mean, for example, we're going to have Howard Dean on tonight on Crossfire. My guess is Governor Dean, coming out of a state that is experimenting with single-payer in Vermont, will advocate going. He'll say the problem with Obamacare is that it's an inadequate compromise and doesn't go far enough.
No, but well, let me rephrase this then. Perhaps we had several members of the Democratic caucus, House members, arrested in front of the White House a week or so ago, and it got so little coverage that I frankly can't remember what they got arrested for. I mean, I think it was protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, but it was something else. Oh, it was the immigration bill. That's right. It was there was the and they got arrested. And if Ted Cruz had gotten arrested in front of the White House, or, I mean...
Well, look at the coverage Cruz got, not getting arrested, just standing there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Michelle Bachmann just, you know, and Pete Sessions just showing up at the World War II Memorial. They didn't have
to... Now you know what it's like to be a Republican. Most of the time...
You get all kinds of press.
...ignores the Republicans and highlights the Democrats. And, of course, you know, you have to start with, you do have the president, and he gets a lot of coverage. So it's a little bit
But see, I think this has been true for most of our lifetimes, Newt. Right.
And that's why, frankly, if you had George W. Bush in, you didn't get very much coverage of congressional Republicans. Because, the Republican budget at the newsroom...
But the Democratic pushback was... Pardon my interrupting. The Democratic pushback was not being covered.
Well, it was against Bush. I mean, look at the whole fight over the war and the intensity of opposition. That got to be a huge ongoing fight with the left, and I think is one of the reasons Hillary did not end up getting to be the nominee in 2008, is that it turned out there was a huge part of the country that was fed up and did not want business as usual.
Yeah, the war in Iraq. Very interesting. Yeah.
So I tell people when they talk to me about Cruz, I just say, I can't quite imagine a first-term senator getting to be president, can you?
Right, yeah.
And then they break up laughing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we have.
We have now the greatest divide between the rich and the poor, arguably in the history of the nation. A few months ago, it was worse than it was in the 20s, maybe a year ago. And now this research out that shows that children who grow up in poverty by the age of 3 have 30% fewer vocabulary words, that there's actually neurological damage associated with growing up in poverty. We know what the Democratic answer to that was, Lyndon Johnson's, Great Society. And Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in the United States over a six-year period and arguably set the stage for an entrance into the middle class of a lot of people, many of them people of color, many of them white, who just never had that door open to them. What is the Republican solution to poverty in the United States?
Well, look, I think we are faced with a genuine crisis, largely because of the way our education systems have collapsed. If you look at the data, the number of young people who can't read, remember that any data about high school seniors eliminates the people who've already dropped out.
But that data parallels the data that shows the rise in poverty. And we know
right.
that children
question,
of poverty don't do well in school.
Is,
so how do you deal with poverty?
Well, and the question is, which do you think comes first?
Poverty. The science is unambiguous about it.
Look, I'll give you two radical ideas that you will probably dislike intensely. The first is, I think that we should maximize learning at the earliest possible age, and we should even be prepared to pay for it. I used to do a program called Earning by Learning, and in the summertime, I would pay children in public housing $2 a book for every book they read. You would be astonished how many poor children are actually willing to earn money at an early age. If you tie and who are willing to sit down and read books. And we had one young girl in Villarica, Georgia, at 9 years of age, who read 83 books that summer. Now, she would never have had $166 any other way. And it gave her a sense of connecting achievement with reward in a way that, frankly, got her in trouble when she went back to school because she could read too well and she was no longer in the regular curriculum. And she made, she asked the teachers too many questions.
Money at the problem.
I'm saying, first of all, incentivize the students, break them loose from terrible, sterile, bankrupt systems of credentialing where they are bored to death, and give them every opportunity and every incentive to learn as rapidly as possible. Remember, when I was first Speaker of the House, I testified the Ways and Means Committee, we should give every child a computer. And Governor.
Yeah, I know. You called yourself the education speaker.
Maine actually did it for seventh graders.
Yeah.
But I would look at trying to get every child at the earliest possible age to be directly in touch with the world of work, the world of achievement, and the world of learning, and break past all the barriers that we
I don't disagree
have.
With that, but how do you deal with the fact that their parents are broke and they got no food in their house? What's the Republican solution to that?
I mean, first of all, I don't fully understand in a world that has Medicaid, earned income tax credit, food stamps, public housing, what percent of the population you're describing.
Okay. Newt, we will leave it at that. I want to get your wife in here. We're just going to take a quick bump out.
Good talking with you.
GingrichProductions.com. Newt Gingrich, thank you for being with us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Still looking for that answer. What's the Republican solution to poverty? But someday. We'll be right back. And with us now is the president of Gingrich Productions, the author of Ellis the Elephant, historical children's books. The latest is Yankee Doodle Dandy. The website is GingrichProductions.com. Calista Gingrich. Calista, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Or Mrs. Gingrich.
Call me Calista.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. This book, first of all, why Ellis the Elephant?
Well, in writing children's books, you need an interesting and unique character to capture their attention. And I did consider many animals, including bunnies and hippos and giraffes. And in the end, I could not resist this adorable little elephant, Ellis the Elephant, who was brought to life beautifully by my illustrator, Susan Arciero.
Right. No, you didn't consider donkeys, did you?
I didn't.
I figured, okay. You say that this book, I apologize that I haven't had an opportunity to read the book, and I try to do that when I have people on, but for some reason we didn't get this from your publicist.
Okay, well, no worries. This book is really about patriotism and our nation's humble beginnings. It's not a Republican book or a conservative book, but mm-hmm. a pro-American book, and I really hope it will appeal to all American families as a celebration of our patriotism and of our nation.
Yeah. You cover the Boston Tea Party. Do you point out that that was a revolt against the largest corporation in the world at that time?
Well, we don't say it that way for 4 to 8 year olds, but we do go through the pivotal moments that have defined the American Revolution.
Yeah.
This is the third volume in my Ellis the Elephant series, and the series offers a guided tour of American history for 4 to 8 year olds. And in this book, Ellis the Elephant, who is my time-traveling pachyderm, discovers the American Revolution and how America became a free and independent nation.
That is absolutely great. Calista, keep writing good books.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. I much appreciate it. Let's see here. Chuck in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind today?
How you doing?
Good.
Watch the show last 2-3 years.
Thank you.
Being as I'm here in St. Pete, I have three items I'd like to touch on.
Mm-hmm.
One, today is the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, where almost 300 Marines lost their lives thanks to Reagan.
And Reagan then turned tail and ran.
Thank you. Also, Steve Kerr, the broadcaster on, I guess, TNT or whatever, you know, was a guard for the Chicago Bulls.
Right.
On that same week, his father was a professor at the American University in Beirut. He was executed by the same people that blew up the Marine barracks.
Okay.
And third, being as I'm here in St. Pete, in the 13th District, great number, the dishonorable Bill Young will be laid to rest today, and his carcass was flown back on a C-17 that you and I had to pay for to bring him back from Bethesda Hospital to here. Why is that?
Well, it's because he was a politician, and he, you know.
So what? They keep going after Obama when he's on Air Force One. And also,
his wife told Charlie Crist not to come to the funeral. That was pretty bizarre.
Exactly. That was his wife that did that. Also, his two sons, who were high school dropouts, worked for Honeywell that poisoned all our water here in the Azalea area through Raytheon.
Huh.
And people are dropping like flies from cancer, and it's never been cleaned up, and he's covered that up.
Yeah. So you wanted to just give us a This Moment in History Day.
Yeah.
Chuck, great job. Thanks a lot for the call, and we'll be right back. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in St. Petersburg, Florida. We'll be right back. Was pointing out that I was disappointed that Dick Durbin said that he would entertain, quote, reform. We all know what that means of Social Security. Now, Chris Van Hollen, he's the head guy, the head Democrat on the House Budget Committee, told Reuters that he would be willing to consider some changes to big entitlement programs like Medicare. This is so sad. Can you imagine a Republican, anywhere in the United States saying, yeah, I'd be willing to consider raising taxes on rich people. I'd be willing to consider raising the inheritance tax. I'll put that on the table. We can, you know, I'm going to want a pound of flesh for it. I'm going to want you to privatize Social Security, but I'd consider raising taxes. They're not going to go there. Why did Democrats talk like this? I don't get it. I don't get it. Bob in San Francisco. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I was on the phone an hour ago, and I found myself asking for a credit downgrade this time to parallel the one 2011 for what I would have said would turn out to be the same reason, the dysfunction and the blackmail tactics. And failing one, there may be revisionist history that doesn't see those 2 years, this year and 2011, as being complete replays of each other.
Sure. Well, wait 3 months.
I don't want enough. Sorry?
Wait 3 months. I mean, they didn't lift the debt ceiling and keep the government going. They did it temporarily. They did it for 3 months. And you've got a bunch of Tea Party Republicans who are really wanting to come back for another bite of that apple.
All right, so bring it on now. If it's going to happen, let's do it when it's so clearly no cuts are asked for. I mean, maybe that will occur to them to ask for cuts during this next phase, so that they look like they're not only about blackmail, but up to this point, it was blackmail. It was about Obamacare. It wouldn't have made any difference to our fiscal condition, yes or no, on Obamacare. Just has never made a difference to PATH first place because it was deficit neutral.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm seeing this conference committee as a train wreck. You've got Bernie Sanders on there who is absolutely not going to allow them to cut Social Security. And you've got Paul Ryan on there who is absolutely not going to allow them to raise taxes. So what are they going to do?
Actually, I was going to mention Paul Ryan. In his nomination expectance speech, he said Obama was the one president to preside over a debt downgrade. By Standard & Poor.
Yeah.
To be able to say that again, you know, with just as mendaciously as the first time,
yeah.
Except for the fact that someone should point out no one asked for cuts this time, and that's why there won't be a downgrade. That's too bad, because the point is being lost that it was so fully deserved this time for dysfunction as it was last. In fact, it was so much a repeat that no one has shown an ability to learn at all except by not asking for cuts.
Right. And this is the fact that this is the big, thank you, Bob, for the call. I think this is one of the biggest problems we're facing as a nation right now, is that the average American thinks that the crisis America is facing is a debt problem and a spending problem. When in fact, the crisis that America faces is a lack of jobs. And that lack of jobs is a function of trade policies and taxation policies. The biggest crisis that we actually, the two biggest crises that we have are lack of jobs and massive inequality. And until we take these things on and name those problems, ain't nothing happening. And I mean, you heard Newt Gingrich. Okay, Newt, what's your solution? Oh, we don't, you know, let's give money to little kids to read books. Well, you know, it's a nice stunt, but really? Anyhow, Martin in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to KABQ. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Oh, Tom.
Hey.
Good to hear you.
Thank you.
Well, number one, kudos. I just appreciate the fact that somebody is talking about facts as opposed to specious arguments. And I love Newt, by the way. And
you do? Seriously?
Emotional nostalgia.
Yeah.
Oh, Newt, yeah.
He, it was like, you know, when he first came on.
He's the king of a.
Yeah. Like I said, he used to be my congressman. I used to live in Marietta, Georgia. And when he first came on, I've had him on the show before, and we've had debates. And I thought, you know, shall I just really go after him and say, you know, how can you live with yourself or some, you know, really inflammatory thing? And I thought, yeah, it might get me a headline or something on, you know, it'll get me picked on by Fox News. But who cares? It would be gratuitous. I'd really rather say. Go ahead.
No, it's just Newt is obviously the smartest guy in the room, so let him be the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
You know, it's something to do with his time.
Yeah.
The point that I had called on was two things that really kind of niggle me a little bit. I live in Albuquerque. I'm in the second poorest state in the country. and I'm surrounded by people with no education and no skills, and they're starving to death. I've got employees. I own a small restaurant. And I love these people, and I wish I could pay them more, but, you know, I can only pay them when I can pay them. But the point is...
Well, why don't you raise your prices or take less money yourself, if that's the issue?
Oh, I have, and well, I've been living low on the hog since I bought the place.
Okay.
But the issue that I see, and call me a traitor to my class, but, you know, I went to B school with these morons. We are basically, the corporate feudalism is coming back.
Yeah.
And people have, the problem I have with the Democrats is they've been what I consider to be a defensive crouch for at least the last 25, 30 years.
Yep.
Really since Carter.
Yep.
And they need some good marketing people because the Republicans are winning the narrative.
I absolutely agree. But it's not just that. It's the problem is money in politics. You've got Democrats who, if they started talking like Lyndon Johnson, they would lose all their corporate sponsorship. I mean, you know, President Obama would not have gotten elected if Wall Street hadn't thrown a whole pile of money into it, which I believe is one of the reasons why he's not prosecuting these guys. And you know, which is not an indictment of him. It's an indictment of the Supreme Court saying, here's the new rules for the game. And this is what is so wrong. So, anyhow, Martin, we're out of time. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to KAB. We'll be right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour here on Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Here's this really serious question. How do we deal with poverty in the United States? I think we do it by rolling back the rate of tax. Where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Program. Be sure to check out our new video over at lasthours.org, by the way. Could we be looking at the last hours of humanity? Well, I don't think we are. I think that there's a positive future, but I do think that it's important that somebody speak out and say, you know, the downside isn't just that we lose Florida. It could be a whole lot worse than that. Phil in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Phil, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Great.
Hey, I got a bit of a rhetorical question, but now that Newt's gone, it's not about him. Why is it when ever there's a financial crisis, the Republicans always say, well, what about the children, the future of the children? Always hear about the children. Well, when it comes to cool stuff like solar energy, wind turbines, getting us off of fossil fuel, anything that ruins or destroys the air, water, ground that we need to live on, they don't worry about the children.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an excellent point. And that's an excellent point. I should have thrown that at Newt. Phil, thanks for calling. You raise a good one. Bill in Laurel, Montana, you have a way to fix welfare?
Well, Tom, a fellow Henry's hamburger worker, about your age.
You must be an old-timer, like me.
Yeah, I'm an old-timer, and I've been watching the show for the train wreck that you spoke of in the second hour last Friday. I wanted to comment and tie it all together.
Okay.
Newt Gingrich helped Bill Clinton institute that go to work or you don't get any help, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, imagine a world. Let's get John Lennon on the train here. Being as I was a conductor and I'm an expert on derailments and train wrecks.
Okay.
We could stick this and help the Affordable Care Act by immediately raising the minimum wage.
Yeah.
It can't be $1 or $2. We've got to scale up to $10 to $15 to corporations that can afford it.
Yeah, well, we should do it. It should be set at $12 tomorrow morning because that's where it was in 1968. I mean, let's just get it back to where it was when we knew that it worked.
And just imagine if they did this young lady I know in Portland that works for the city could go part-time work, not have to worry about her health care, instead of working three jobs to make up for her benefits that she's losing because the city won't pay her full-time and those benefits, and we can cut the neo-Confederates off at the knees
right,
so that they would have to hire more people, creating jobs, more tax. Well, they ought to be tickled to death with that type of thinking, you know.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, I don't disagree. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Kathy in Abilene, Texas. Hey, Kathy.
Yeah, I have a question. I mean, I have the answer to Nuke's question about showing the group of people.
Yeah.
That group of people is the average middle class who's living from paycheck to paycheck, yep, who don't qualify for food stamps, who don't qualify for everything that the low income qualifies for, because they're told they make a couple dollars above that paycheck.
Right. And they're trying to maintain a single family home rather than moving into subsidized housing, which is kind of a scary place.
Right. And I honestly think, excuse me, the poorest people in America are the middle class, because they don't get nothing. They're making it from paycheck to paycheck. And when they do raise the minimum wages, like my daughter, she was so happy she got a raise. And I'm like, yeah, but just wait. Your insurance will go up. Taxes will go up. The food will go up. It seems like the government should put a freeze on these companies to let them get ahead.
Yeah. I don't disagree, Kathy. I think what we need to do is we need to raise the minimum wage. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. We need to change our crazy trade policies, rather. And we need to do something about an out-of-control Supreme Court. And Congress actually has the power to regulate the Supreme Court. It's right there in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2. And they should be doing it. They should be saying the Supreme Court cannot claim that money is speech. Sorry, can't do it. Kathy, thank you for the call. Ken, by the way, one of the things I want to mention, Ken, hang on just a second. One of the things I wanted to mention that was in the news that I saw yesterday and I wanted to riff on a little bit, but I just want to put it out there. 58% of Americans think pot should be legalized. I'm not talking about medical marijuana. I'm talking about just, you know, if you want to grow it in your backyard, fine. 58% of Americans, that's a majority. You got two states that have decriminalized, that have legalized recreational use of marijuana, Washington State and Colorado. There are more to come. This is a big deal, and there's a big conference starting today in Colorado, or maybe it started yesterday. No, I think it starts today in Colorado, runs for 3 days, on this issue. And we're going to try and get somebody from that conference on this program in the next day or two. But I think that we're at the edge of ending Nixon's failed drug war, at least when it comes to pot, and that would be a good thing. Ken, you wanted to talk about Social Security and IOUs in Lebanon, Missouri?
Yes, sir. My name's Ken Hurd. I'm in Lebanon. I'm 71 years old. Without Social Security, I'd be in deep trouble. And over the last 25 years or more, I've heard on the news that the government has been borrowing money from Social Security and giving them IOUs. Has the government ever paid back those IOUs? Because I heard somebody saying recently that Social Security is going to run out in 2020, which I don't believe.
No, it's Dick Durbin said it was going to run out in 20 years, but in fact, it's in 27 years. Social Security will only be able to pay 70% of benefits. So we've got a whole generation to solve this problem, and the easy solution, of course, is either to get our economy back so that there's more people paying into Social Security. That would solve the problem. Or just lift the cap, do Social Security as a flat tax so that billionaires have to pay the same amount of Social Security, same percentage of their income as you know, average working people. But Ken, in answer to your question, Social Security was borrowing from the government, was borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. Let me change the language for you, and I think it'll suddenly all make sense, okay? What you just quoted to me has been the line that has been put out by the Pete Petersons and the Wall Street billionaires who want to get their hands on that $2.7 trillion Social Security Trust Fund. They want to say it shouldn't be, government IOUs. It should be with us on Wall Street so we can make some money off it. Let me rephrase it. Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus. They got all this money. What's the safest investment in the world, Ken, by most standards? It's U.S. Treasuries, right?
It's Social Security.
No, the safest investment, if you had $100,000 in your savings account and you went to an investment advisor and said, I want to put this in something for the next 10 or 20 years that I know is not going to, I'm not going to lose my money, what should I do? They would say, buy Treasury bills.
Yeah.
You with me? Okay.
Yes.
So that's what Social Security did. Social Security took that $2.7 trillion and they bought Treasury bills with it. Now, what Treasury bills are, technically are government IOUs.
Okay.
So, you know, when you say Social Security, you know, has been loaning money to the federal government and all they get back are IOUs, that sounds really nasty. But when you say Social Security is sitting on $2 trillion and it's invested in the safest investment in the world, U.S. government treasuries, it sounds like a perfectly sensible thing to do.
Okay, so the future of Social Security is in treasury bills.
100% of it. By law, by the way.
Answers a lot.
Pardon?
But, you know, if these Republicans keep acting like they are and default on payments in a couple of months, what is the value of that Treasury bill going to be worth?
Well, the Treasury bills will still be paid back. This country is vastly wealthy, and you know, we have wealth that's unimaginable. And the 14th Amendment says the full faith and credit of the United States shall not be questioned. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And even if it did, it would not affect the treasuries. The treasuries would get paid, especially the treasuries to Social Security. The question was, you know, will the Social Security checks get cut because the government workers are being laid off or because, you know, the money isn't flowing through the system the way it should. But the investment that Social Security has made is as solid as any investment on earth. Every country in the world, every rich person in the world wants to put some of their money in U.S. treasuries because it's the safest investment on earth. U.S. treasuries are technically IOUs from the U.S. government, but we have never defaulted on them in our 230-plus year history, and I don't think we ever will, even if the Republicans go totally crazy train. So, Ken, not to worry. Thanks a lot for the call, though, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to clean up this right-wing story that's been out there for all these years. Steve in Navasota, Texas. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment on your comments about marijuana legalization. Now, first of all, I'm a conservative. I'm not a Republican. I'm a conservative.
Okay.
But I find it just idiotic that we should criminalize the use of a plant.
Right, a weed that grows in your backyard.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, we had an industry in hemp which could be used for making oil, it could be used for making fabric, and when they made hemp growing illegal, they destroyed an entire industry.
Right, and there is a conspiracy theory that it was the paper barons who were challenged by hemp, the wood barons, who were selling to the paper industry, and the oil industry, the Rockefeller bunch, who were intimidated by hemp oil, who led the charge to criminalize hemp. And there's a fair amount of evidence for that. But all of that is behind us now, I'm with you. Hemp is a great crop. It could do a lot for this country, and marijuana is a hell of a lot better as a drug, if you're going to get high, than alcohol. Steve, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. Check out TomHartman.com. Free live chat room. It is so cool. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Wayne in Wilmington, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, I was thinking, watching your show, that it's a little bit off topic today, but I was wondering if any of your viewers ever thought about this fact in relation to the NSA and the type of information they're gathering up and storing. Most of your security people, both on the private side and on the federal side, are ex-agents.
Right.
And
we paid to train them.
Exactly. And they may leave after a year or two. A lot of them do these backgrounds, the Snowden-type backgrounds and contractor backgrounds. And many of them were not successful in their careers, but they go out on the private side, and they seem to be able to get these types of investigations. But what I thought was worth mentioning is that many people, when they retire, they access information through their old agencies, either through, you know, personal contacts with people who are currently on duty. Many of these people, you know, would never violate a law and would never cooperate in making that information available, but Some do. Some do because they're trying to curry favor. They're going to retire soon. They want to get a leg up on the industry. And so I'm saying that when this information is obtained, it's stored, it's there. It's not sacrosanct. It can always be accessed. I think there may be often crimes that are so heinous that they people say, well, we're just going to use it once, just for this particular crime. And then the more it's used, the more people become used to it and accept it.
So you're making the slippery slope argument for the danger of our privatizing national security and these for-profit firms seeing other ways beyond the immediate thing that they've been hired to do to make money with the data that they're collecting.
Oh, absolutely. There are literally thousands of people out there who are investigators, and most of them are very ethical and honest. But some who were unsuccessful in their careers as far as making cases and getting the job done, they look for the easy way to do things. And sometimes this information is accessed. I mean, just look at the situation with Hewlett-Packard a few years ago, obtaining information about people who were calling people, and how do you think that information was obtained? It's through contacts. So,
yeah. So what's the solution?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just saying that I believe that the explanations provided by NSA that this information is never accessed and never will be accessed for any kind of nefarious purposes is just not a trustworthy statement. I just think this stuff is out there and it can be used, and people should be aware of that.
Yeah. Okay. I agree. I think that I have two pieces to a solution to this. Number one is bring back the ban on the revolving door. It used to be that you had to make a choice. Are you going to spend your career in the private industry, or are you going to spend your career in the public industry? And the revolving, and you had to wait anywhere from a year to 5 years, depending on the law, depending on the agency, and depending on whether it was state or federal, before you could make that transition. And so people didn't, unless it was a really big case. And number two, anybody who does should not be involved in lobbying. Lobbying should be outlawed. Welcome back. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Free-Don.org. Victoria, hi.
Hi, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
This is your Obamacare-free news bulletin.
Okay.
Because really, with the exception of people introducing laws to do this, that, and the other thing, delay this, delay that, Jay Carney not answering questions, nothing has genuinely happened today.
Right, and probably really won't until December.
Right, and there will be a hearing next week in which Kathleen Sebelius will testify, and that will be news. But really nothing major happened.
Yeah, but it'll be news the way that, Ali fights Frazier. It's going to be, the Republicans tried to beat up a cabinet secretary, and the Democrats came to her defense, and she either kicked their butts or she deigned not to. And, we can write those stories right now and just say, okay, we'll take story A, story C,
Yes. So I thought I'd bring you some other stories.
Good. Thank you.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel called President Obama after she received information that the U.S., i.e. the NSA, may have spied on her mobile phone.
Did she call him using her mobile phone?
I suspect that she used a landline.
Yeah, I suspect so.
Possibly a payphone.
If they still have those.
If they still have those. A spokesman for Merkel said the German leader views such practices as completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And she called on the officials to clarify the extent of their surveillance in Germany. Der Spiegel said that the information came from its investigations. Well, Jay Carney told reporters in Washington, I was there today, listen to this language, the United States is not monitoring and will not monitor the communications of the chancellor. And that President Obama had told her that. And her English is pretty good, and I think she understands the present and future tense, as well as the past.
So is not and will not, they said, but he did not say did not?
It's not in that statement.
Oh, very interesting.
Yes.
So basically what Jay Carney announced today was a policy change.
Well, they have been saying, actually, for some time that they are reviewing how they collect intelligence. They are saying that they're reviewing how they collect intelligence.
Right.
They are saying that.
Very interesting.
So this is a bit of a spat. And, of course, as you know, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff canceled a visit to the U.S. this month because she was so furious at the alleged electronic espionage by the NSA against her country, including communications at her office.
Right.
And as we know, the French are furious this week with us as well, as are the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
It's come out about both of them. Today, former Representative Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly are delivering a blunt letter to every member of Congress, signed by 100,000 members of Americans for Responsible Solutions, the advocacy groups that Giffords started after she resigned in 2012, a year after she was severely wounded, and six others were shot dead at a constituent meet and greet in Tucson. The letter reads in part, "We have disturbing problems, gun crime, mental illness, and the easy access that dangerous people have to guns. Congress, you must lead." And they were prompted to draft the petition after last month's Navy Yard shooting and decided to release it now, after this week's incident in which a 12-year-old Nevada boy fatally shot his math teacher, a Marine veteran of Afghanistan.
Do you know if her seat was filled by a Republican or a Democrat?
No, it was filled by a Democrat, by,
okay,
I believe, a former member of her staff.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so it's,
yeah,
so it's unlikely she's going to go back and run for office now.
Yeah, I don't think she will.
Yeah.
I don't,
okay,
think she will.
All right.
Also, House Democrat is introducing a bill today that would toughen anti-money laundering laws and place an emphasis on penalties for executives, also give a Treasury Department Bureau greater enforcement powers. It's the Holding Individuals Accountable and Deterring Money Laundering Act. It's being introduced by Maxine Waters and Carolyn Maloney. And what it would do is it would target top brass at firms that come under scrutiny for their anti-money laundering controls. It would raise the maximum prison sentence for willfully evading an institution's Bank Secrecy Act program or controls to 20 years from the typical cap of 5 years.
Hmm.
What else does it do? It also says it raises questions about other tactics that have become a regular part of the anti-money laundering enforcement tool. It says that independent consultants who often are imported to monitor a bank's compliance program after a firm gets into a mess, they should be held to the same standard as bank employees if they commit wrongdoing. Currently,
whoa,
they're not.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
Now all we need to do is define lobbying as money laundering, which I think it is, and we're off to the races.
There you go. There you go. Democratic leaders today renewed their push for a House vote on immigration this year.
Mm-hmm.
Speaker John Boehner offered a smaller commitment to the issue. Steny Hoyer, the House whip, said, "Bring this bill to the floor." This is a bill that 184 Democrats signed. "Bring an immigration bill to the floor. We will pass it." Boehner was asked at a press conference and said, "I still think immigration reform is an important subject that needs to be addressed, and I'm hopeful."
He's hopeful that he himself will just drop the bill on the floor and let it be voted on. I mean, that's all he has to do is say, "Okay, you guys want to have a vote?"
Well, that's the question. Is it going to be piecemeal bills that talk about border security, legalization, or is it going to be something comprehensive that talks about a pathway to citizenship?
I mean, the Senate's already passed a bill, right?
Bipartisan.
And that bill, if it was dropped on the floor of the House by John Boehner, would probably get passed because all the Democrats,
right,
would vote for it, and there's probably 30 or 40 Republicans who would vote for it. And so Boehner's is saying that he's hopeful that he himself will do the right thing here?
Right. But
really?
He doesn't have a majority of the majority.
I know,
that.
But when he said, "I'm hopeful," did the reporters all fall down laughing?
I hope so.
It's incredible. I mean, it's just incredible. It's like he's speaking of himself in the third person almost, like, Well, maybe that guy will do the right thing. I don't know. I hope so. Incredible. Victoria Jones. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, tomhartman.com. If you support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible, there are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Pope has suspended the Bishop of Bling. I keep thinking maybe becoming Catholic isn't such a stupid idea. I don't know. Maybe not. Anyhow, Tuesday night, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul showed up on Sean Hannity's show over on Fox So-Called News. And during that interview, Senator Paul called out liberals. He said, liberals have no idea how capitalism works. Let's just set the record straight. It's Senator Paul who apparently has no idea how capitalism works because, like most Americans, he confuses capitalism with free enterprise. I mean, let's look at this. At its core, the economic system we have here in the United States is based on a couple of basic things. Number one, the right of any person or group of people to run and operate a business, at least a legal business. And number two, the right of any person or group of people to buy goods or services from the business of their choice. It's just pretty simple stuff. This is called free enterprise. Right? You can start an enterprise. You're free to start an enterprise as long as it is legal. That's not called capitalism. Now, I realize that, you know, the people have, over the years, the definitions have gotten fuzzy, sort of like democracy and republic. But free enterprise is a system designed to give people the broadest choice of goods and services possible and reward those people who provide the best goods and services. We call them entrepreneurs, right? If you ask somebody like Rand Paul, he'd say somebody participating in this sort of a system is a capitalist. In fact, if you walked up to probably 100 Americans on the street in any city or any rural area in America and said, are you a capitalist? Probably 95 out of 100 would say yes. Of course I'm a capitalist. I'm an American. Aren't we all capitalists? Sorry. The cleanest definition of a capitalist is someone who uses their money, their capital, to make more money. They make money with money. Some capitalists do this by investing their capital in the stock market. Others do it by investing in other people's startup businesses. They're called venture capitalists. And arguably, these kind of capitalists play a role in our society. I mean, sometimes they help small businesses get on their feet. But here's what you're not going to hear on Fox News or CNBC. Capitalists are not that productive, and they aren't actually necessary. Many of them are just like Paris Hilton. They sit on their butts by the pool all day waiting for the dividend check to come in. They make money while contributing absolutely nothing to the rest of society. And here's the thing. Free enterprise works just as well without capitalists, capitalism, or even venture capitalists. Worker-owned cooperatives are just as successful as any business backed by money from Wall Street. The Mondragon Cooperative in Spain, for example, employs more than 90,000 people, including more than 250 companies. It generates $25 billion a year. There are no capitalists involved. It's entirely owned by its workers. As long as the people running a business are committed And by the way, people would say, oh, the Mondragon people, you know, they are the capitalists. No, they're not making money with their money. They're making money with their labor. So as long as people in a business are committed and their customers like what their business sells, it's going to succeed. I mean, free enterprise works with or without capitalists. People say, oh, Hartman, you're a capitalist. I have never made money with money. I've tried to. I can tell you. I've tried to. I've tried to invest money in the stock market. I have net in my life lost more money than I made, which is why I think that Social Security is a fine thing. And, we all should have pensions. We shouldn't, this 401k thing, it's crazy. Anyhow, I digress. Too much capitalism is actually dangerous. All the major economic crises in the past 200 years, every single one of them, was caused by a capitalist on Wall Street trying to make money with their money, trying to make more money with their money. And here in America, we seem to have forgotten this fact, and we've forgotten the difference between capitalism and free enterprise. Wall Street and their allies in the Republican Party have taken advantage of this to gut the regulations that keep out of control capitalism, or at least did back in the day, from the New Deal to the Reagan Revolution, keep it in control. And they've done this while they've been, free enterprise. Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, we got to deregulate the banksters. It'll help everyday people. Right. What's good for the bankster capitalists is not good for the rest of us. That and some friendly Supreme Court decisions are why America is the most unequal country in the developed world. And poverty in this country is at an all-time high. I mean, just consider this. This is how bizarre it's gotten in this country. During the Reagan administration, capitalists who, they pay their own special tax rate, income tax rate. If you're a worker, you pay what's called earned income. If you're a capitalist, you pay what's called capital gains. And during the Reagan administration, capitalists paid the exact same rate as earned income, even though they have their own tax rate, as if they're divine beings. But then Reagan cut the capital gains tax and raised the tax on working people. Right now, the top capital gains rate is 20%, whereas the top earned income tax rate for working people is 39%. And to add insult to injury, working people pay payroll taxes on top of that income tax, and most capitalists don't. There is a really simple fix for this. I mean, aside from fixing Rand Paul's ignorance about our economic system. Yeah, good luck with that one. Yeah, and that is to, and I think this is obvious to anybody who understands the difference between capitalism and free enterprise, or anybody who, like me, has been in this. I've been in the world of business for my entire life. I mean, Louise and I did start a nonprofit at one point, which we donated pretty much all of our money to. And never, not as a loan, never got back. I mean, that was a good thing. I'm proud of having done that. But the businesses that I started, the first business I ever started, I started with an unemployment check. I mean, I lived on unemployment while I started this company, which technically, I guess, is against the rules. But, hey, I wasn't making a profit. I didn't make a profit for the first year and a half. And I was only on unemployment for a few months. But in any case, the most profitable business I ever started, I started with a $15,000 line of credit on my American Express card. That's not capitalism. That's being an entrepreneur. So why is it that we treat capitalists, Paris Hilton, Mitt Romney, why is it that we treat the people who make their living, the people who make money with money, we treat them differently? Why do we have a special tax rate for them? We need to diminish the role of people who only want to make money with money, the capitalists. They should pay a higher tax rate than everybody, frankly. You want to make money without working? You want to make money by just, buying stock and sitting back and getting the dividends like Paris Hilton does? You pay a higher tax rate than people who actually work for a living. Or at the very least, I think that the simple way to do this, we could do it naturally, if we just stopped giving capitalists special treatment of the tax code. I mean, right now, thanks to the low capital gains tax, predator capitalists like Mitt Romney and spoiled heiresses like Paris Hilton pay lower tax on their income than working Americans do, just because they make money from money instead of from working for a living. There shouldn't be a bigger incentive to make money by investing than money running a bakery. If we stopped rewarding capitalists for just being capitalists, that would even the playing field. And combine that with, you know, for example, small business loans, entrepreneurs get a bigger advantage. So, simple solution here. Just a simple solution. Do away with the capital gains tax. Make all income the same. Everybody pays the same tax rate. Let's ditch capitalism and embrace free enterprise.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or at least say capitalists, you know, you when you make money, it's going to get taxed the same as the bus driver, as Reagan put it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert in Ironwood, Michigan. Hey, Robert. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. You had been asking for a new definition of capitalism.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking reverse fascism.
Reverse fascism. How is it reversed?
Well, the government owns the means of production. In our fascism, the means of production or the corporations own the government.
Oh, so actually it would be reduced communism. Because in communism, the government owns the means of production.
We're a fascist state if you look at the how the police shoot people who are called 911 and everything.
Yeah.
But, one other thing, Tom?
Yeah.
Would you please keep giving us updates on Fukushima? Because this relates to that. GE is responsible, and they are not allowing the news to be out.
You will be very happy with the guest that we're going to have on in 3 minutes.
You're a good man, sir.
We are doing a Fukushima. It's going to be John Bertucci, I believe it is, the communications director with Fukushima Response. So, yes, we will continue with the Fukushima updates. Robert, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Gary in Mount Hermon, Louisiana. Hey, Gary, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I wanted to comment on the marijuana issue that you were speaking of earlier. First of all, I'm calling you from southeast Louisiana, deep in Jindal country, so please keep us in your prayers.
Oh, my.
Okay. There's a lot of us that don't think that way.
You have my sympathy, and you are the reason why I have not been calling for all-out secession of the South. Because I know that there's a bunch of good people living in Louisiana.
Thank you, sir. But anyway, back to the marijuana issue. I think that first of all, I have medical issues that it does help immensely, and I don't have to take the pharmaceuticals and stuff. Mm. But, you know, I do it at my own peril. And
that's the problem. I know people who have had cancer and had to do chemotherapy, and the only thing that could keep them that kept them from just falling over barfing continuously was that they could smoke pot, and it solved the problem from the chemo. This is not rocket science. I mean, there's literally hundreds of thousands of people who've reported this in the United States. It's legal in 20 states. I mean, back to you, Gary. I'm sorry.
There's still too many that have that Almslinger or whoever it was that come
Perry up
for madness. Yeah. They still have that mentality, you know. And
yeah.
I don't know, but if we were to legalize it completely across the board, it would eliminate all of the criminal element.
Mm-hmm.
You eliminate the Mexican cartels, the guy on the corner, you know, that robs your house at night, you know. You'd eliminate all of the criminal element from it.
Yeah, this is why I forget which South American country it is. Was it Bolivia? They're talking about next year, starting January 1st, they're going to sell marijuana for $1 a gram. So, I mean, you know, the government's got to be doing it, so. It's actually a piece of legislation that's moving through their Congress, but it looks like the Senate's going to vote on it this week. So I just have to remember which country it is. It's in that region of Northwest South America, so Bolivia, Ecuador, one of those countries. But anyway, Gary, thank you for the call. I'm totally with you. I think that the pot prohibition is stupid. We'll be right back. past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and John Bertucci is with us. He is the communications director with the Fukushima Response Group. FukushimaResponse.org is their website. And John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
So, what's going on with Fukushima? What's the latest?
Oh, the latest. We just got a date for the attempted removal of the rods. It's either the 8th or the 10th.
Is this from Unit 4?
From Unit 4, yes. That was on Fukushima Diary this morning, and I believe TEPCO put out something that they're going to start on the 8th.
Of November?
Of November.
While Mercury is retrograde. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, yeah. Well, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't on that one.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So we had in the first hour of our program, we had a woman on from the let me get the group name here right. Miriam Gurman of No Nukes Northwest, and Twitter at No Nukes NW, and they're doing Geiger counter checks around the Portland area, and she said that just a few 3 weeks ago or so they had a hot rain where they're hitting every now and then 60 counts per minute. And they had one that was over right in the neighborhood of 190 counts per minute. Are you familiar with this? Are you associated with any of these groups?
I'm familiar with them. I'd like to hook up with them. We're Sonoma County based. That's just north of San Francisco. There's about 20 of us in Fukushima Response, and we've been working for about 2 years. We put a lot of our energy into this mural on the beach at San Francisco, but that's in the bag. So now we're looking at other projects, and one of which is citizen monitoring networks.
Yeah, because they're doing a lot of citizens monitoring. They're also finding that the tuna coming in is in many cases very, very hot radioactively, and they're trying to raise the money to get a mass spec machine so that they can find out exactly which radioactive elements are in the tuna. I mean, odds are it's cesium, but who knows? And cesium's pretty nasty stuff because the body thinks it's potassium and builds muscle out of it. And then it gets in, and then we eat that fish, and it becomes our muscle, and then it slowly radioactively decays and just nukes all the muscles, and boom, you got problems.
Yeah. We've got the good fortune of working with Dan Seith of International Medcom. They've been producing Geiger counters for 30, 40 years, and Dan has worked with Three Mile Island Citizen Monitoring and was very instrumental in getting Safecast up and running in Japan.
Cool.
So we're going to try to set up something on that same model. The trick there is the Geiger counters have GPS and satellite time, and it all goes onto a little chip that you can plug into your computer and upload to a collective database.
Right, or just put on the web in real time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but you have not yet started that.
Well, we've done some testing of debris on the beach. I did some testing at the beach when we did the mural. It was all baseline at this point for us here.
Well, that's good.
At least the readings I'm getting, yeah.
That's good news. I have a Geiger counter, and just one of these little $400 buy it on Amazon units or whatever. I bought it on the internet. I don't think it was Amazon, but and it seems fairly sensitive. I mean, it picks up background radiation. I'm getting here in D.C. Maybe 5 or 6 hits a minute, which is not a whole lot. It's fairly low background radiation. But I keep threatening to walk into a store and start, walk over the fish counter, but my wife won't let me do it. I've got to negotiate this with Louise.
It's a little trickier than that. Dan's got a device where we can put it in overnight. It's reading 360 degrees with lead casing, so it's not getting background.
Ah.
We did some tuna in that, and it came out okay.
Yeah.
Starting now with the baseline readings is important so we can read the fluctuations as they arrive.
Yeah. Well, for people who are into fish, when Fukushima went down, that would have been the time to buy 5 cases of kippered herring, and just say, okay, that's it. Of course, they're fairly low on the food chain, herring and sardines. That would be a way to avoid radiation.
Well, you did catch that news item about the sardine catch up north. Didn't happen this year. There aren't any sardines left.
No, I didn't catch that. Why is that? Is that because of global warming, because of the ocean currents?
We're getting mainstream news, and they say they scratch their heads and say experts are stumped. But it's the kind of thing that gets posted on the Facebook pages I'm checking.
And right.
I check about fire.
Well, there's a lot of conversation about how, 90% of global warming is going into the oceans. And the oceans are absorbing a massive amount of carbon dioxide, converting it to carbonic acid. It's lowering the pH of the oceans, and it's making it hard for these diatomaceous, these small animals that have calcium-based shells around them. Some of them are almost microscopic. They're so small, and they're the bottom of the food chain. And they are eaten by the smaller things that are eaten by the larger things that are eaten by ultimately the sardines, you know, that then get eaten by the bigger fish. And so if they're going, if the bottom of the food chain is going, then you would expect to see that problem with the sardines. You ever read Cannery Row?
Yeah, I did.
John Steinbeck's novel? That was when the sardines used to run in Monterey, and they no longer run there. So it might just be changes in ocean currents, or that nobody knows why they stopped. I mean, it might have been overfishing, too.
I'm just calling up that article, but... Yeah, it's a delicate balance. We're at a tipping point, I'd say, in a lot of different fronts. But Fukushima grabbed us two years ago, and we've been working bringing Japanese guests to speak locally. The beach mural was our major event, and that's gone global. So we're really trying to keep up with that one.
That's a great thing. So what's coming up is they're going to try and get the reactor rods out of Unit 4, the one that's listing. Where all this tons of nuclear material are like 10 stories in the air. And, boy, that's going to be a tough job. That's going to be a very dangerous job.
Yeah, it would be hard to do in a regular functioning reactor. But this is a damaged pool. It's actually 100 feet up. You know, and there's a lot of discussion because it did go dry, that pool, early on. So people are really wondering what the true status is. If TEPCO's moving on it, I would say that there are other issues that are forcing their hand. You know, the ground's getting very soggy. The spent fuel pool in Unit 3 has been emitting steam.
Yeah. So they might be near some sort of a meltdown that they're worried about.
Yeah, I think the worst-case scenario kicks in when they abandon the plant.
Yeah, I'm with you. John Bertucci, thank you for being with us, John.
Okay.
FukushimaResponse.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Check it out and start your own local group, FukushimaResponse.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is very interesting. Nearly 600 pets have died. 3,600 have been sickened. This ongoing mystery illness tied to jerky treats made in Canada. 10 cats have been sickened, too. My cat Higgins is sick, and I remember getting them some treats before he got sick. I wonder, these things come from China. They still haven't figured out what caused it. What's in these things that's killing these pets? But 60% of the problems are gastrointestinal, 30% kidney or urinary troubles. Fanconi syndrome has been reported. Anyhow, this is the problem with libertarianism. You solve problems after the fact rather than, you know, regulated capitalism. You look for problems before they happen. Like, you know, you have the USDA saying, "Oh, we're going to test this stuff." Bruce from Houston, Texas, driving through Chicago listening to WCPT. Says, you're a capitalist and you want to debate me on the capital gains tax?
Yes, the capital gains tax rate should be an absolute zero.
Okay, you're a capitalist. Tell me about your capitalism.
No, well, first off, I'm a venture capitalist. I'm a private equity. I make private equity investments, and I also operate and own companies. And as a result of my investing money that has already been taxed, at the ordinary income rates the first time that I earned it, you now are asking me to take a risk to invest in other businesses that employ people, that create growth, create jobs, and create economic prosperity.
Yes, and let me ask you a question, Bruce.
And wait, let me finish. That money, not only has it already been taxed, when I invested in a business, that business itself pays income tax.
Yeah, Bruce, you have so much sympathy for me. My heart is bleeding for you. Let me ask you a simple question. When I get a paycheck, my money has already been taxed. So because my money has been taxed, and also I own my own business, and the business has paid a tax on its income. So, you know, my business has paid a tax. I pay a tax. So my money has already been double taxed. So when I go out and buy something, should I not have to pay sales tax?
Sales tax is a completely separate, it's completely separate tax from an income tax. Frankly, I wish we...
Well, how is it different, Bruce? If I go to a restaurant and I have a really nice dinner and I get a lot of pleasure out of that, I get something back for that money, but I have to pay a tax on that. Or if I take that same money and I put it in the stock market and I make back a little money and then I have to pay a capital gains tax on that. I don't see why the fact that money, in fact, if you can identify for me, Bruce, any form of money that you or I have ever had in our lives that wasn't previously taxed, you win the argument.
Well, it's easy. You're talking about tax multiple times. The first answer is if you have money that's been taxed and you inherit money, if you're a surviving spouse, you get it tax free.
If you inherit money, that money had been taxed when it was earned.
Correct.
And that money was earned from a company that probably paid taxes on the money, and that company got that money from customers who had paid income tax when they bought the products. You know, there's this totally specious argument that because
your argument is an invidious comparison, because sales tax has nothing to do, that is a tax at consumption. That is not a tax on capital at investment level.
So what?
It makes an enormous difference.
No, it makes no difference at all. Listen, Bruce, let me just play a clip for you. Here is the guy whose logic I'm following, okay? Here he is.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. In theory, some of those loopholes were understandable, but in practice, they sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing, while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy. Do you think the millionaire ought to pay more in taxes than the bus driver, or less?
Now, what Reagan did in 1983 was, or in 1985, excuse me, was he lowered the top tax rate down to 28%. He raised the capital gains rate up to 28% because Reagan said that people making money with their minds or their hands should not pay a lower or higher tax rate than people making money with money. And you're arguing to me that you're making money with money, which you just happen to have because after tax money, sure, but it's your money. You making money with money is somehow so superior to my making money with the labor of my mind here on this radio program that I should pay an income tax on the money that I take as, you know, in my salary, but you should not pay an income tax on the money that you take from investing money. That seems to me, to quote Ronald Reagan, crazy.
No, I'm very familiar with Ronald Reagan. You've taken that quote of his completely out of...
I am absolutely not, Bruce. Go back and look at the record. He made several speeches on this issue, and he, as I said, he equalized. It's the only time in the 20th century, or actually the only time since World War I, that the capital gains tax and the earned income and tax were identical. He raised the capital gains tax to 28%. It had been at 20%, and he lowered the top income tax rate. At that point, it was at 50%. He lowered it down to 28%. So they were the same for about 12 months.
But you just pointed out one critical point of the analysis, and that is the tremendous lowering of the income tax rate. There was a slight raise in the capital gains tax rate, but an enormous cut in the income tax rate.
Right, and that has led to the evisceration of the middle class and to enormous wealth at the top. Yeah.
Right. No, the situation. Well, first off, that's a whole other issue. The fact is that there is no such, this enormous wealth at the top is actually a misnomer. If you look at the IRS data by Social Security number by individuals, you will find that there is a tremendous migration. People earn lots of money some years, earn very little money other years. It goes back and forth. It is not a static.
You know, Bruce, there are 10 guys on Wall Street last year who earned over $2 billion each. And because of the carried interest loophole, which is considered capital gains, they paid a maximum income tax of 20% on that money. Do you really think anybody can do anything that is worth $2 billion, and that if they do, they should pay only a 20% income tax rate when a bus driver can pay up to 39%?
I couldn't care less. I have no problem with that. How many millions of people were employed as a result of the companies in the business?
I would say those banksters probably threw 5 or 6 million people out of work. Look at the great crash that those banksters caused in 2008. But back to the original argument, Bruce. You're making the argument. I'd like you to try and make this one more time in this context. I work using my mind doing this radio show. I'm paid to do this by my own company, but I'm paid to do this, and I pay income tax on that money. You work by taking money that you have earned or inherited, doesn't matter, by taking money, after-tax money that you have, and investing it. And you get a return on that investment, and that's how you make your living. Why is the way that you make your living so superior to the way that I make my living that you should pay no income taxes and I should pay 39%?
That's an easy question to answer. What if my investment was owning the broadcast company that allowed you to have the job to make the money that you earned? Then why should the tax that I would pay would be an ordinary income tax on the...
Are you, Bruce, really so unaware of how business works that you think...
I wouldn't pay capital gains on it.
Bruce, are you so unaware of how business works that you genuinely believe that the only reason somebody would buy or own a radio station is because they got their money tax-free?
You're completely missing my point, deliberately, but that's okay.
Well, apparently I am.
No, the issue is the act of investing.
There's nothing noble or special about investing.
That's what creates prosperity in this country.
No, I'm sorry. What creates prosperity in our economy, Bruce, is people buying things. You, as an investor, and people who own businesses like me with this radio show, we make money because people buy things. People listen to our sponsors, and they buy things.
But
they're the ones who are making the money.
Things without employment. Look at what's going on with this abomination of an economy. People do not have money without employment and jobs and growth.
People don't have employment without demand. If there's no demand in an economy, nobody's going to start a business.
Nobody's going to start it right now. Nobody's going to start a business with the risks to capital posed by Obama and the Democrats.
Oh, give me a break, Bruce. That's the most pathetic Republican talking point. First of all, corporate taxes are at the lowest they've been in 60 years. Individual income tax rates are absurdly low. I mean, you compare this with the great prosperity from the 40s to the mid 80s when the top tax rate was above 50%, was above 70%, and we had a solid economy. We had four decades of growth of over 3.2% GDP decade to decade. That has never happened before or since. So, you know, we're looking at the tail end of Reaganomics here, but you're still trying to assert that rich people investing is what creates jobs. And I'm telling you, rich people investing are what exploits labor. It is the people who are working in the companies that you are investing in who are producing the wealth that you are taking out of those companies and so nobly saying you should not pay income tax on.
But
you want those workers to pay tax, right?
Without capital to invest, there is...
Okay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're getting into totally circular logic here. Bruce, look up worker-owned cooperatives. You don't need capital to start a business. Or look up entrepreneur in the dictionary. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rick in Geneva, Florida. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, well, after you guys really just beat the stuffing out of capitalism there, it's...
I guess.
What I was going to say was, a lot of people confuse or conflate capitalism with democracy.
Well, that is the effort of the Ayn Rand folks, yeah.
That's Eddie Bernays.
Yeah.
Back there when he made the world safe for democracy.
Yeah, you're right.
Was the pitch, right? But
yep.
The reason that we went into World War I was to protect
the bankers' investments in the European countries. So
that's one theory, yes, and it's probably right.
We're making the world safe for capitalism.
Yeah.
That's what it's really about.
Yeah.
But, you know, I ran a business for a long time, and it took some capital to start it, even, you know, a few $1,000s to start an auto repair business. But something that...
But you can borrow that capital. You don't have to get it from a capitalist. You can get it from a banker.
Hey, I got it from my grandfather. His life insurance left each of us grandkids $10,000.
There you go. There you go. So you didn't need a capitalist.
Tools, you know?
Yeah. Or, you know, and I'll bet that the major investment in your company was sweat equity. I'll bet that you worked without a paycheck for a long time. I know the first 3 years of this radio show, I didn't take a penny out of it. So, you know, whatever I'm worth, three years of my labor was put into this show to make it what it is, and, you know, to be able to pay other people and pay myself as well. I can't, you know, monetize that or go back and say, you know, and that can't be taxed, which is kind of good, I suppose. Anyway.
Well, you know, the first thing that got me going in the car business was the credit advanced by tool men, right? Snap-on mm-hmm. tool truck comes around, and it sees you there, and it'll sell you some tools, and you just pay them weekly.
Yep.
And pretty soon, you know, you've got the tools of the trade. And, you know, that was the first real extension of credit that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked really well.
Yeah.
But you know,
but that's not capitalism either. That's extension of credit. That's, you know, you're engaging in free enterprise.
Right. Well, but, you know, a little credit really helps. If you're not making any money,
yep.
you're going to make some money. And you just need to make it before you can pay the bills. You know?
I agree.
But you know, capitalism or democracy, when you go to work, if you go to work at Walmart, you leave democracy at the door. When you get to work, democracy is over.
That's right. Workplaces are feudal systems. They are empires, basically.
Right.
I mean, you know, some are more or less democratic. I think small businesses lean a little more democratic because the boss has to look the workers in the face. You know, you have to the boss has to interact with the workers, and so there's a level of it's a far more level playing field than one of these things where you've got some company in Germany that owns the factory here in the United States, and they just make decisions, and poof, people are gone.
Right. Well, that's all. It's middle management, people who are trained to be cold fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really sad. I was just reading about Sinclair Broadcasting bought a bunch of radio stations in Portland. They just laid off a whole bunch of people in Portland. And, you know, I've seen friends go through that. It's just a really, really sad thing. Rick, thanks for the call. Thanks for your comments. You're right. People do confuse democracy with capitalism. And it's a bad thing. We'll be right back 10 minutes before you. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced, and still defending. You don't need cash. Here's the simple thing. You know, the argument of our previous caller was that businesses don't happen without capitalists, without people investing in them. I have started 7 businesses. Only once did I ever have an investor who brought money in and who took stock in the company. In other words, a capitalist. And that, in retrospect, was a mistake. I should have, you know, that was the travel agency we started in Atlanta in 1983. We sold in 1986. If we started it from scratch, by 86, it was a $5 or $6 million a year business. That business went on after we sold it to do over $250 million in business. I should have hung on to it. They just merged into a multi-billion dollar company last year. And in every case, in every business I've started, and Louise and I have started 7 businesses, built them up, well, 6 of them anyway, built them up, sold them off, take a year off, then go back and start another business. I mean, that's been the story of our lives. And in every single case, we've done it with our own sweat equity and our own money, no capitalists, or our own line of credit. You don't need capitalists to start a business. Now, you know, venture capitalists, there are. And frankly, I think that if we were to expand the Small Business Administration, we could do away with the need for venture capitalists altogether. Not that I'm opposed to it. What I'm opposed to is somebody saying that, you know, my stuff doesn't stink because I make my money by investing in companies. Whereas the people who work for those companies, they got BO big time. They got to pay taxes. But I shouldn't have to pay income taxes. Are you kidding? Because I put my money at risk. You think people who show up at the job every day aren't putting their lives at risk? Or entrepreneurs who start a business, like I said, you know, the first couple of years of this radio show, we made not one penny. It cost us money to do this. Anyway, Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hi,
thanks for listening to Sirius.
You definitely. At the beginning of your show, you asked, you know, how our country might be different if we hadn't had these three fraudulent Republican, you know, presidents, right?
Yeah.
And I think a big one. I know you've talked about this, but I think it is sometimes underestimated how significant this is. This cancerous knee-jerk hatred of our government, and we're automatically there are some legitimate things to, obviously you need to have the health, you need to have a healthy suspicion, and
oh yeah,
and
Proxmire's old Golden Fleece Award was great, you know, and well, the $500 right. toilet seat, he, you know,
right.
he,
no, that there are very legitimate, I mean, you have to keep a wary eye to all
sure.
time, but we've gone so beyond that where the word government itself basically makes it elicits paranoia and hatred. It's very, very toxic. I remember it used to be cool to be considered, and when John Kennedy was president,
mm-hmm.
and even after that, being part of NASA was considered cool. I kind of miss that myself, I'll be honest with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, me too.
I think it is an honorable profession. It should be, and it often is. And that's all. That's I just wanted
yeah.
to mention.
Well, it's very, really very well said, Will. I totally agree with you. And there's been this change, and the reason for the change is that the billionaires have been funding this meme. Because when government stops doing things, it creates an opportunity for wealthy people to step into that void and make money off it. So if the government stops inspecting our food, then, you know, the food companies can make a higher profit selling worse food, for example. Melissa in San Diego. Or if the government stops maintaining our roads and private companies come in and put up toll booths or parking meters in Chicago, for example. You know, Mayor Daley's brilliant idea. You know, figure out a way to make a buck, right? Melissa in San Diego. Hey, Melissa, what's up?
Hi, yes, I have a couple of things to say. First of all, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your clearness and getting past the rhetoric and public and political agendas.
Thank you.
So I want to thank you so much for that. The other point I wanted to say, we were talking a little bit before about welfare and some of the other major issues, and I just wanted to throw out there the point that if we kind of followed the pattern of Obamacare and paralleled that to some degree in investing in public transportation systems, really bringing public transportation to fruition in a major way, there's so many benefits that would be claimed from that, not only creating jobs for people, but allowing people who have less income to ride those transportation systems to then be able to get to jobs.
Right.
And, you know, it's also helping the environment, and the list goes on and on. So that's one thing that I would say, although it's kind of not directly intuitive that that would help welfare, but it seems like it would be an important consideration for us all.
Right.
Which
reminds me, this is another thing that venture capitalists are living off of, which is the commons, which we're all paying for. They don't want to pay any taxes, but they want their businesses to have public roads run to them, which we all pay for. They want their workforces to be educated in our public schools, which we all pay for. They want their contracts to be adjudicated in a court system that we all pay for, but they don't want to pay any taxes. That's like totally bizarre. Melissa, thank you for the call. Richard in Morton Grove, Illinois. Hey, Richard, we got a little less than a minute. All yours.
Yeah, I only need less than a minute. There's going to be a Sierra Club rally at an EPA meeting that's going to be held November 8th at the Region 5 Metcalf Federal Building, Lake Michigan, Room 77 West Jackson Boulevard, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. I will be there. I need to testify for the fourth time. I've been trying to make a point each time I've gone, the same point that lasthours.org makes, which I am grateful to you for spreading that message. And I really need listeners to please please show up at this EPA meeting and support this this climate change hearing.
Once again, when, where? Real quick.
Better.
When, where?
It's again, it's going to be on November 8th at the EPA Region 5 offices, Metcalf Federal Building, Lake Michigan, Room 77 West Jackson Boulevard.
Okay, in Chicago. Great.
From 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Chicago, yes.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. And coming up tomorrow, California wants to secede. We're going to talk, another county wants to secede. We'll get into that. And don't forget, get over to lasthours.org and check it out. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.